Thanks very much, Lenore, and thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen, for making me so welcome. It's a pleasure to be here at CEDA because CEDA brings together some of the best minds and the most involved practitioners in all the various areas that it covers. Lenore, I'd like to think that one of the reasons why health is not currently at the federal level a front page political issue is because of the political skills and management qualities of the minister. But I'd also like to think that more importantly, it is that because we have a fundamentally good health system and it is serving its purposes appropriately and efficiently. And I think this is the point that we really should start with. Any consideration of health reform has got to begin with what are the real strengths and what are the real problems of our system. And in trying to address those real problems, we need to be conscious of its real strengths and be sure that in tackling problems, we don't compromise its strengths or damage it in unforeseen ways. And I have to say that a lot of the proposals that you see around for reform do involve, in my opinion, fundamental damage to what is at heart a very good health system. There are two basic directions for proposed reforms of our health system. One direction is for more marketisation. The other direction is for effectively more government or official control. And I think there are serious problems with both of those fundamental approaches. Whatever faults our system has, and it isn't fault-free, I believe that we have avoided most of the problems of the American system because while here in Australia we think there is a place for the market in health, an important place for the market in health, a vital place for the private sector in health, a significant role for price signals in health, nevertheless it will always be no more or should be no more than a managed market at most. Health is not just another commodity. It is too important to people. Without your health, it is impossible to exercise the sorts of rights and freedoms which we believe are essential in a country such as ours. So we must always be cautious in the application of standard economic theory to something as important as health. On the other hand, we must also be cautious about the application of standard official goodwill to something as important as health. So much damage is done by people who rush in to solve problems, brandishing their good intentions. They can do so much damage by unwittingly interfering with things which are actually working far better than they might seem. One or two difficulties does not indicate a systemic crisis. Even some serious problems do not necessarily indicate a systemic crisis because there is no human system which is problem-free. And if every time a problem arises, we conclude that the system must be changed, I suspect that often we make things worse for the real live human beings on whose judgment and confidence and skill we must inevitably rely to make any system work. So it's a good system, and I am a believer in incremental change, not fundamental reform. I am a supporter of the market. I think that the market has an important role to play, but we make a big mistake if we ever try to throw the economic textbook as something as important and difficult as health. What are the problems which government and our society deals with when it comes to health? Well, I suppose they are the standard problems which in their own way bedevil everything, and that is the availability of services, and the cost of services. Now, there's been a lot of talk, constant talk really, of the cost of health services. The talk tends to focus either on cost to taxpayers, if you're reading the Financial Review, or cost to consumers, if you're reading the Daily Telegraph. Now, taxpayers pay about two-thirds of the total cost of our health system. It's a lot. And we need to ensure that taxpayers pay no more than is absolutely necessary. Now, all of you, this being CEDA, would be very conscious of the intergenerational report. The first intergenerational report suggested that health costs were exploding unsustainably and that we would shortly face a system where the health, a situation where the health system placed such burdens on our economy as to seriously impede economic growth. Let me just caution people against alarmism on this score. The first intergenerational report posited a doubling in federal health spending as a percentage of GDP, and the implication was unsustainability in the long term. Let me take you back for a moment to 1960. In 1960, total spending on health was about 5% of GDP, compared to about 10% of GDP today. Has that doubling of health spending destroyed our economy? No. Has that doubling of health spending impoverished our society? No. The real net wealth of Australians is four times greater today than it was in 1960. And in part, our real net wealth has grown so much because we are a much more productive society. And one of the reasons why we are a much more productive society is because we live longer and live healthier. Life expectancy at birth in 1960 for Australians was 71 years. Today it's 82 years. And all of you would know that one of the key differences between Australia today and Australia a generation or two back is that middle-aged people do not normally die of heart attacks. Some still die of cancer, but most don't. And this means that so many more people are so much more productive for so much longer. And that is at least one of the explanations for our greater wealth. Now, as long as rigorous cost-effectiveness tests are being applied, there is no reason why continued increases in health spending will not generate far more in terms of economic and social return than they cost. However, we do have a significant problem of costs to patients, and that is what our system is designed to ameliorate. So we have our Medicare system to subsidise costs of patients seeing doctors, the pharmaceutical benefits scheme to subsidise the cost of life-saving or life-enhancing drugs, and we have the public hospital system to ensure that essential treatment is provided free. There are all sorts of cracks between these various systems, and notwithstanding private health insurance, notwithstanding the relatively new Medicare safety net, many people still face significant costs. The government is always trying to address these issues, most recently by trying to ensure that people do not face large unexpected bills for private procedures through insisting on informed financial consent being provided before procedures. And I have to say that the campaign which the government is running in conjunction with the AMA seems to be working, at least to some extent, there was a 20% improvement between late 2004 and late 2006 in the rates of informed financial consent for private hospital procedures. But there is more to be done in this area, and the government will shortly be conducting a further survey. And if that survey does not indicate a further satisfactory improvement, well, then more action will be taken. The availability of services. Well, look, we are on the one hand trying to reduce unnecessary demand and on the other hand increase necessary supply. Probably the biggest single supply problem in our health system today is the availability of workforce. The government is massively expanding training places for health professionals at our universities, and we are trying to ensure that those graduates have better opportunities to specialise and to specialise in the right places. Just to give you one example, in 2005 there were about 1,500 medical graduates from Australian universities. By 2011 there will be almost 3,000 medical graduates, and that's HECS-funded medical graduates from Australian universities, which is obviously a doubling. And we're also trying to limit the demand on acute services by providing better care for people with chronic problems. As our population ages, there will be more people with chronic disease. Rather than have these people flooding into emergency departments, we are trying to ensure that they are better treated by GPs in the community. We've put more practice nurses into GP clinics, which should take at least some of the burden of treating chronic disease off the doctor's shoulders. We are trying to get the doctors more focused on wellness and maintaining it rather than simply treating episodes of sickness. We are trying to move our system towards that old notion that where possible, prevention is better than cure. And while changing any health culture is hard, I think significant change and improvement has been effected. In the last financial year, there were some 650,000 GP care plans. These involve long consultations. They involve significant discussion with patients about what needs to happen to improve the patient's general health. There were, as I said, 650,000 of them in the last financial year. 250,000 patients on GP care plans received team care plans, which meant that they could be treated by a range of allied health professionals with Medicare funding. There were some 500,000 consultations delivered under those care plans. We had almost 300,000 Medicare-funded health checks. All of this is concrete evidence of a system which is changing in ways which are going to be much better for the health of Australians in the long run. So, look, I was told I had 15 minutes to talk. I think I've put health reform into a necessary perspective, but I think I have also indicated that the government is always looking for ways to make a good system better, but we believe it is nearly always done by building on our existing strengths rather than turning the whole system upside down. Never forget the costs of transition. And when we're talking about systems involving almost 1 million people, dealing with 20 million people, many of them on a very regular basis, inevitably dealing with some of the most acute and difficult problems that anyone can have, you've got to be very careful lest renovations and rebuildings mean that the whole thing just doesn't work for people.